Okay. So, well, you've all read the advertisement, I hope. And maybe I want to say a few more things about it. So, the topic is not theory. The question made simple, and then later it gets refined, but the question made simple is how to tell knots apart. So, you have a trefoil knot and the R-knot, and possibly the mirror image of the trefoil knot. Let me try to write it, to draw it. Yeah, I think this is the mirror image of that, more or less. I guess the mirror is vertical, horizontal, sorry. And the question is, are they the same or not? And there is some definitions that one has to go through to explain what does it mean that they are the same, basically whether you can deform one to the other. But as should be clear from reading the abstract, this class sort of wants to do something more advanced, so I will actually never go through the precise definitions, but only encapsulate them in a certain way later on. So the question is, can you deform this to this? Can you deform this to that? Can you deform that to that? And it's actually not obvious. So intuitively, you may look at it and think that you can't, but it's not terribly difficult to show examples of things that look knotted, that look as if they're not equivalent to the R-knot, but in fact are equivalent to the R-knot. So they're somehow very, very, very complicated, twisted together in a very, very complicated way. And in fact, you can deform them to the R-knot. So what should make you sure, how would you know that you cannot somehow twist this around to something extremely complicated and then untwist it to be the trefoil knot? Alternatively, twist the trefoil knot around in a very complicated way and then untwist it to be its mirror image. And in fact, there are examples of knots that are equivalent to their mirror images, so for which this is possible to do. Actually, not for the trefoil. So, how do you do that? How do you prove that all of these things are not equivalent? You find what is called a knot invariant. So you find a function I stands for invariant, but invariant really means a function on the on such things. So it's just a synonym for function, if you wish. Okay, but when you say invariant, you actually mean that, mathematically speaking, it's just a function, but the thing you have in mind when you say invariant is a function which is computable, so it's actually somehow easy to mechanically compute it, or not too hard to mechanically compute it, and with values in some simple-minded space. So, you know, one invariant of knots is the identity. It maps every knot to its equivalence class modulo these deformations that I'm not allowing. Okay? It's very easy to compute. You basically do nothing in order to compute it. But the target space is not simple-minded. The target space is what you started from. So it's not terribly interesting. Okay? So the idea is to replace is to find computable things with values inside things that are in which it is easy to detect whether two things are equal or not. So the integers, polynomials over the rational numbers, I don't know, any other matrices, any other things in which it's easy to detect when two things are the same or not. And then you compute the invariant of this, and you compute the invariant of this, and if you're lucky, they come out different. And if they're different, you know that the things themselves were different. Okay, so that's somehow the idea behind the not invariants. Now, there is a whole zoo of not invariants. There is like an unbearably large collection of not invariants that people have defined in various ways, and the first of those we will go through today. One of them, perhaps the first, is the so-called Alexander polynomial, and we will not go over it today, we will go over it later. So the Alexander polynomial was first defined in 1928, and in some sense it remains the best invariant we have. And the sense is that it's the only invariant we had until a year ago that was computable in polynomial time. So that you could compute it for knots with, in principle, thousands of crossings. So, well, these knots are simple, but, I don't know, take a molecule of DNA, which is some germs, by the way, have circular molecules of DNA. And take a DNA molecule which is extremely, extremely long, and throw it away and throw it into under a microscope, and you'll get a huge knot with, you know, just thousands of crossings. And then you'll want to ask yourself, is it knotted or is it just tangled up version of a round circle? And basically the only reasonable tool until a year ago was the Alexander polynomial. There are plenty of other invariants, including much stronger invariants, but they're all much harder to compute, so that if you have a huge knot, you cannot do anything about it. A year ago this changed, or in fact in some sense it changed already 15 years ago when Rozanski defined an invariant which I now call rho 1, and then about 5 or 6 years ago Overbay, a student of Rozanski, computed rho 1 for the first 50 or so knots in complexity, but they either didn't know or failed to state that their invariant was actually spectacular. So in fact it went totally unnoticed, and including by myself. And then a few months ago, Roland van der Veen and myself, somehow rediscovered rho 1 and then realized that it is the same as this rho 1. But when we rediscovered it, we sort of deliberately constructed it in such a way that it was manifestly polynomial time. So it was manifestly computable for huge knots. That's part of what this class is about. Okay? So The other parts are the math that go into this computation. So it's something about non-standard calculations that people do in, that you can do in Lie algebras. So somehow it's known since a long time ago that knots are somehow related to Lie algebras. And if you haven't seen this before, this should come as a surprise. Because if you've seen anything about Lie algebras, they don't look anywhere like knots. Okay, they look like the topics should be disjoint. However, it's been established a long time ago that that they are related. And in fact, given a Lie algebra and a representation thereof, you can compute a knot invariant. And these invariants are pretty strong. However, these computations are intrinsically exponential time, and therefore you can only compute the invariant for relatively small knots. What van der Veen and I do is we find that there is an alternative way to extract information out of Lie algebras, not using representation theory, and use it to compute knot invariants. Okay? Now, in a polynomial time way. So one thing I want to tell you about in this class is, how do Lie algebras connect to knots? What is our new way of extracting information? We actually need to look at an unusual class of Lie algebras in order to do that. So sort of there is interesting mathematics that goes into this construction. Since it's somehow about in computer implementation, I actually want to implement everything. And hopefully we will start with this today. So everything that we do, we will implement. And if you want a sort of side goal of this class is to teach you how to implement potentially very sophisticated algorithms relatively quickly using Mathematica. And then finally, basically as a challenge to myself and as a challenge to you, I decided that the best way to teach this subject is to go beyond it. So in some sense, this Rozhansky over Bay invariant is the invariant associated with the Lie algebra SL2. And then the purpose of this class, so our purpose, is to replace this by the same thing with SL3. And I have good reasons to think that it is hard. I have good reasons to think that it is possible. I have good reasons to think that this invariant will be much stronger than that one. I should say that this one is much stronger than the Alexander polynomial. So we actually benefit something by switching to it. So I have good reasons to think that this invariant will be much stronger than that one. And I have good reasons to think that if you try to look at row 1 of SL4, you will find that there is nothing new in it. So it's kind of a good place to try to aim, a good destination. There is actually a further generalization, which should be row 2 of SL3. And it will be much stronger than this one. However, it will also be a lot less computable. So for the purpose of this course, I think this will be a nice sweet spot to aim for. Okay? Right. So just to be clear, it's going to be a hard class. Hard because the concept that goes into it are somewhat hard, and not on, and worse that they are hard, they are not fully baked. They're not fully baked because everything is very, very fresh. On the other hand, well, you know, it's as exciting as mathematics can get, I think, if you actually can sort of get to the front line so quickly. Okay, so as for structure, so I'm going to split the course into two, which are two pieces which are going to run in parallel. So for about the first half of the semester, I will spend two-thirds of the time on part one, which I'll call it the gentle part, and about one-third of the time on the brute part. And then towards the later in the semester, the proportions will switch to the opposite. And the idea will be, in the gentle part, I will give a general introduction to knot theory, and in particular, the parts of knot theory that are most relevant to understand this. And in the brute part, I will just head as quickly as I can towards the construction of this, of what I expect to be the new invariant. So in particular, you know, the gentle part will be the place to ask questions like why. So why are we doing this? Why are things working out the way they should? And in the brute part, the questions to ask are how. So, you know, how to work out a certain formula, how to implement a certain formula, without thinking too much about where it arose, how it arose. Okay. Questions, comments? Okay. So, okay. The class will have a web page. The URL is on the screen right now. Currently, the web page has very little information on it, but there will be more as we go on. The technicalities, so basically the classes are at certain time in certain places, but you know that already since you're here. We will have an extra meeting on Fridays at 6:10 p.m. I'll tell you why later, but it will be near or in my office. My office is right there. So, you know, on the other side of this blackboard. So it's very easy to find. The instructor is me, all the other information is here. The agenda, I already told you what it is. By the way, an alternative way to state the agenda is to say, okay, here is the handout of a talk that I gave in 2016, and you have a copy of it as a part of your about this class handout. And this explains row one. And our agenda, our task is to beat it, okay? To do better than that. To first of all fully understand it and then do better than that. So I think I said all of this. I think I said the warning. I think I said all of that. The prerequisites. So basically mathematical maturity, and I don't know what mathematical maturity really means, but it sort of means have a general no fear of mathematics and sort of, well, in this particular case, it means absolute total comfort with linear algebra, so vector space, duals, quotients, tensor products, and some appreciation of Lie algebras. So what I mean by some appreciation of Lie algebras is obviously you need to know the definition of a Lie algebra, but also you need to have seen at least one theorem about Lie algebras in the past. Somehow, I don't really care what, but you have to feel comfortable with Lie algebras. And basically that's it. Okay? Everything we will say, we will immediately implement. And it's completely pointless to take this class if you don't have a copy of Mathematica. I will implement everything in Mathematica. And it's completely pointless to take this class without owning a copy of Mathematica. Sorry. A student version is $150. You could say it's expensive, but many textbooks are comparable price. And at least my personal experience is that it's an extremely powerful tool. So it's well worth having it and well worth learning how to use it. And in fact, that's kind of one of the side purposes of this class. Keep the receipts, and I will make every effort to refund your expenses if you are officially taking this class. So basically, if you're here in order to get the refund, then I will not refund it. However, if you actually take this class and participate meaningfully, I will refund it. At some point, I hope to take a class photo, and it will replace the micro class photo that appears here on the class website, not the micro, the placeholder. So everything is on videotape because I actually think people from the outside will be watching it. I mean, I know people who intend to watch it. So everything will be videotaped. And there is a system for annotating the videos, and one of the pages on your handout describes how it works. I will not go through it, but it will be kind of it should be clear once the first video is up later today. This annotation goes through a wiki, which is a part of my website, and there are all sorts of rules how to manipulate it, and I don't think I want to go through it right now, but if you plan to edit, you should read this. I think there are some more rules here, and I should say that to get an account on the wiki so that you can actually edit, annotate, add comments, you have to email me your full name, email address, and preferred user ID, and I'll be very happy to get these emails soon. Okay. So this is now the unpleasant part of marking. So I don't know if and how many of you are taking this class for Mark. But if people are taking it for Mark, basically, there is a whole lot of options how to do it. Maybe if since it's a small class, maybe we will renegotiate it later. But one possibility or one thing that I was meaning to do is to have a homework meeting every Friday afternoon at my office. And the purpose of the homework meeting is to write the homework. So basically, and I did it in a previous class, and it actually works well. So the few people who come sit with me and we go together think, what did we do last week and what good questions are there to ask about it? And then that becomes the assignment, and then this assignment is due later. So that will be a significant part of your grade. A second part will be student presentations. A last part will be a final exam if you're interested. And the most interesting part is that I will assign good deed points for anybody who solves an open problem. And again, the class is about solving open problems, so it shouldn't be so hard. It shouldn't be outside of reach, beyond reach. And then I will offer good deed points for other things as well. So basically, take action, and you will be getting good deed points. You don't have to. I mean, you have to take the initiative. If you do anything good, you'll get credit for it. Okay. Then there is arithmetic, how to the final grade will be set, but I don't want to talk about it. And finally, my own notebook is completely open. It's available at that URL. You're welcome to look at it if you feel like it. And I think that's all I have to say in terms of class introduction. Any comments, any questions? So that's it. Okay. Good. Okay. So again, I'm completely systematic about documentation. So everything will be, basically everything that we do will be documented, including this blackboard, before I erase it. And you will see that the blackboard will appear on the class website at some point. Later, we may make it more mechanical, but at the moment, that's how I do it. Okay, so let's start with mathematical content. And again, I mean, even the gentle part will be a bit brute. So let me define to you, for you, the first knot invariant, or the first knot invariant that we will study, and compute it for the trefoil knot, for these two knots, in fact. Okay, and well, actually, no, for these three knots, so that we know that these three knots are different from each other. Okay? On second thoughts, before that, maybe I should give you an informal definition of a knot. An informal definition of a knot. Okay. So, So basically, what's a knot? So it's a map, a function, gamma, from the circle into, well, either R3 or add one point to R3 and it becomes S3, and it doesn't matter which one you choose, you get the same thing. So maybe I'll start with a wrong definition, just as a tiny warning sign. So the wrong definition is to say that I want a continuous function, and I want to take equivalence classes of such functions, continuous and one-to-one, so embedding, well, continuous and one-to-one, so it's an embedding, and wrong definition, this is not yet a knot, this is a curve in R3, and then a knot would be take this thing and mod out by a certain equivalence relation. And what is the equivalence relation? It's essentially homotopy within this class. Homotopy within the above class, so basically two closed curves, two embeddings of a circle into R3, okay, you know what, let's actually make it knotted. So, two embeddings of a circle into R3 are called equivalent if you can deform one to the other. So here is one, if you can deform it to another, it's called equivalent. Okay? And then a knot is an equivalence class of such embeddings, modulo this deformation relation. Okay? So why is it wrong? It's wrong kind of for an amusing reason. So according to this definition, as it is, all knots are trivial. And the reason is, so take a knot, here it is, okay? So I said embeddings of a circle, and you may complain that this is just a line, right, my belt, but no, the circle continues through my hands and through my body, and the part of the circle that's my hands and my body is not going to do much in what I'm about to do. So all I will do is to pull it extremely tight. If you pull it extremely tight, this sort of bulk, which is the knot, becomes smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and at the limit, it's a single point. That was a continuous process, Throughout this process, everything was one-to-one at all times. So basically, infinitesimally before the knot became a point, it was still a tiny knot, so one-to-one. And when it became a single point, it's just an unknotted circle, so it's still one-to-one. So that was a homotopy within the class of continuous one-to-one functions. So this definition, as stated, is wrong. And the way to fix it, well, there are several ways to fix it, but one way to fix it is to replace continuous by smooth. And I only stated it as a minor warning. It will not play any role whatsoever in the rest of this class. Anyway, okay, now the practical definition. So the practical definition, so this is equivalent via a theorem called Rademeister's theorem to the following definition. So basically, take a generic projection of this curve to the plane. So right, you have a curve in R3 and it's smooth. So if you project it from a random direction, it's just going to be a curve in the plane with finitely many self-intersections. In fact, at each of these self-intersections, you will have, again, generically, just two points overlaying one other, and sort of so it will look like a picture like this, or the projection will look like that. But one of the two strands that go through an intersection is closer to you, and the other one is behind. And the convention is to denote the one closer to you as a full strand, and the one behind is sort of hidden, so it's cut. Okay? So basically, a knot is a curve in the plane with cuts in it, with some cuts in the plane, with this general appearance. Okay? And in fact, if you want it even more combinatorially, so such a curve is really a four-valent graph. So it's a planar four-valent graph. It's a planar four-valent graph. So a graph with four, in which each vertex has degree four. With a tiny bit of further annotations. So first of all, for each degree four vertex, one pair of opposite edges emanating from it is called the upper pair, and the other pair is called the lower pair. Second, there is an orientation going through everything, and the orientation has to be consistent throughout. And again, I'm not saying what it is, but it's clear that you could say it in the language of graph theory. And finally, with the property that if you start at any point and follow the curve, you get a circle at the end. So you come back to where you were after having gone through all edges. Okay? And again, I could write it formally, but the only thing I wanted to emphasize is that it's a completely combinatorial definition. So it's with some annotations and constraints, which again I'm not stating, but constraints. Again, I'm not stating them, but they should be obvious. It's clear that they can be made precise. Okay? Well, okay. That is actually what corresponds to curves. I still have to mod out by the equivalence relation. And the equivalence relation is the harder part of the Rademeister theorem. And basically, there are three local moves that you can perform And the Rademeister theorem is the theorem that's saying that the equivalence relation generated by these three local moves, if you mod out these combinatorial objects by these relations, you get exactly that. And the three moves are the so-called Rademeister 1 move, which says the following: if you have a kink on a knot, you can remove it. So, again, topologically, if you have a kink, then it's equivalent to not having it. Second, the Rademeister 2 move, which says that if you have one sort of strand passing over another one in such a manner, you can replace it by the two strands not passing over each other. And finally, the Rademeister 3 move, and again, geometrically I think it's clear, and the Rademeister 3 move says that if you have a crossing and below it a third strand passes, but it's behind the whole picture, then you can take this third strand and slide it above, so this is equivalent to having the same crossing and this third strand sort of going behind the picture but above the crossing, okay, or blackboard above the crossing. Okay, each of these moves is actually a bit harder than I've stated, because each of these moves has several variants. Namely, the kink could be, like that, or like that. Or, sort of, you could, instead of turning to the right as you kink, you could be turning to the left. But I'll think of all of them as being the same Rademeister 1. But just bear in mind that there are variants. Likewise, for Rademeister 2, these two strands have to be oriented. Everything has to be oriented, always. So these two could be oriented, and they could be oriented either with the same orientation as here, or with opposite orientations as here. And in both cases, I allow you to perform the move. And finally, there are choices here too. And again, I'm not going to go through these choices. This is the, this is a brute class. Okay, I'm taking this as the sort of understood axiomatic definition, if you wish, of knot theory. Any questions, comments?
So when you switch the orientation, you get the mirror?
So actually, there are two Z2 actions on the set of knots. One is to reverse the direction of the arrow, and that's called the reverse or the inverse of the knot, and that's in fact not the one that got from here to here. The one that got from here to here is the other Z2 action, and it is you take every crossing and you flip it. So it's as if you take every crossing and flip it. It's as if you took a mirror sort of parallel to the blackboard and viewed the knot through that mirror. Okay? Alternatively, you could place the mirror in any other way. So you could place the mirror like that and then flip everything relative to that. It's the same mirror action. Okay? Okay. Good. So now I'm in place to define the first knot invariant. So definition, or rather, it's not a definition, but rather I will tell you how to, it is a definition, but let me tell you how to compute the Jones polynomial. So the Jones polynomial is defined by the following three rules. So first of all, wherever you see a positive crossing, I have to tell you what's a positive crossing. So it turns out that crossings have signs, okay? And the sign of a crossing, well, is, well, either plus or minus, and here's how you tell them apart. So you hold one of the strands with your right hand so that your thumb is pointing in the direction of the flow, and then your fingers either point with the other strand or against it. If it's with the other strand, then it's a positive crossing. If it's against it, then it's called a negative crossing. So here, if I do it, my fingers point with the other strand, so it's a positive crossing. Here, if I try to do it again, my thumb is in the direction of the flow on one strand, and then my fingers now point in the opposite direction to the direction of the other strand, so that's a negative crossing. So the Jones polynomial, as defined via the Kaufman bracket, is defined by a certain rule which tells you what to do when you see a positive crossing and what to do when you see a negative crossing. So if you see a positive crossing, you replace it by Q times a vertical smoothing minus Q squared times a horizontal smoothing, and I will explain it in a minute. If you see a negative crossing, you replace it by negative Q to the minus 2 times a horizontal smoothing plus Q to the minus 1 times a vertical smoothing. Okay, what do I mean by that? So what I mean is, if you have a complicated knot, well, let's start from a not so complicated knot. Well, that knot has several crossings. In our case, I guess let me put the orientation throughout. So in our case, all of these crossings are positive. So what you do is you replace each of these crossings so since only positive crossings occur in this particular knot, you replace each of these crossings by either Q times that or negative Q inverse times that. So since you have two choices for each crossing, you overall have eight choices. So let's write one of them. Okay, so temporarily, let's call this option 0, and let's call this option 1. And let me describe what you get when you apply option 0 here, 1 here, and 0 here. Why did I choose that? I don't know, just for fun. That's one of the eight possibilities. So option 0 will... now is a good time for another picture, and you should tell me if we should take a break or my preference will be to complete the definition of the Jones polynomial and then take a break, so that's another 5 or 10 minutes. Is this okay? Okay. So all of these are positive crossings. I look at this mold and I need to take option 0. So option 0, basically this crossing is a bit rotated. So if you rotate in the same way, you find that you need to replace it by this and take it with a coefficient q. So I multiply the whole thing by a q. Then uh, I For the second crossing, this one, I said I will take option one, so I need to replace it by negative q inverse times this thing. If you again rotate it appropriately, you find that the horizontal smoothing is this, next to this crossing, and I'm supposed to take it with a negative q inverse, sorry, negative q squared, so negative q squared multiplies the whole thing. And then finally, this crossing gets replaced by that, and it comes with a coefficient which is a q. Doing this, there are no more crossings. There are 8 ways to do it, so there are a total of 8 ways to get rid of the crossings, but after you've done it, there are no more crossings. In this case, you got a single cycle. Sometimes you'll get more. And then the third rule in the definition of the Jones polynomial is that if you see a cycle, or in general, if you see k cycles, you replace them by q plus q inverse to the power k. So basically, each cycle is worth q plus q inverse. I should have said q is some formal variable. So this particular smoothing gets contributes q times minus q squared times q plus q inverse, and the Jones polynomial of the trefoil is equal to this plus 7 other terms. And then what I owe you is the following things. First of all, I need to compute it. So I need to compute it for the 3 knots that I displayed in the beginning. So compute. Why does it work? I mean, somehow 2 is perhaps should have been 1. 2 is much more important. Why is this a knot invariant? So why is it unchanging under Rademeister at the Rademeister moves? So prove invariance under R1 up to R3. And I'll do all of this in the next hour, but even before that, the result will be the so-called Jones polynomial. The Jones polynomial is very powerful, but not complete. We can see that, we will see that later. If you look at the computational complexity of this, well, already for the trefoil, I will have to add 8 terms, and that's more than what I can do without getting confused. But if you were working with any bigger knot, so basically if you're working with a knot with n crossings, you'll have 2 to the n terms appearing, so it grows very exponentially, so it's in fact very difficult to compute. We will actually see later on that relative to difficult to compute thing, the Jones polynomial is in fact surprisingly easy. But even as a surprisingly easy thing, it's still very difficult. The Alexander polynomial will be much much harder to define, but much easier to compute, and row 1 will be even harder to define and still easier to compute than the Jones polynomial. So yeah, that's what we're going to do. Let's take a break now. Can you press red again? Yeah.